Welcome to Literary Quest, a podcast hosted by us, Vicky and Marissa, where we discuss our favorite in fantasy fiction and hopefully can direct you in your quest to find your next great read.
Welcome to Literary Quest. This week, we are discussing The Lady of Rooksgrave Manor by Catherine Moon. This book is a Why Choose Monster romance, so we will definitely be discussing sex, so prepare yourselves accordingly. I'll start out with the characters, and Marissa will pick up with our plot. So we have Esther Reed. She is a young woman who really, really likes sex. She's been let go several times from numerous serving positions due to this. She's open-minded about her sexual partners, eager to please and easy to please. She has several unusual partners: Jonathan Underwood, who is a version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. His alternate personality is Mr. Tanner. She is also with Amon, a sphinx; Auguste, a vampire; Booker, a golem; and Ezra, a human, but he can turn invisible. We have Magdalena Mortimer. She's a witch, and she runs Rooksgrave Manor. She can read auras, and that is how she matches her girls with their men. We have Bersha. He is the bad guy. He's the ex-king of Gamora. He found a way to make himself immortal and invincible. He likes to hurt women and collect monsters. This book primarily takes place in Rooksgrave Manor. There are some excursions to London. This is set in the past. It doesn't give a specific date, but there are corsets. There's no modern technology like phones or anything like that. They mention carriages.
So Esther Reed works as a maid for the Pickerings, a fine family. And Mrs. Pickering, who suffers from female hysteria, gets visits from Dr. Jonathan Underwood, which is where our book starts, with Esther spying on Mrs. Pickering's treatment with Dr. Underwood, her screams of ecstasy and mysterious vibrating sound in the background. Esther, overcome with lust, decides to self-pleasure to the sounds of Mrs. Pickering's joyous cries when she is caught by Dr. Underwood. You see, Esther has a pretty long history of really enjoying sex and getting into trouble or being made to feel shamed for her desires. But Dr. Underwood just smirks at her and continues on. Weeks later, Esther is approached by Dr. Underwood at an auction that's being held at the Pickering's home. Esther is soon to be out of a job due to unfortunate circumstances with the Pickering's finances. Dr. Underwood encourages her to come to his office, where Esther learns just what he uses to treat hysteria. She discovers that Dr. Underwood isn't exactly human, and that a home called Rooksgrave Manor exists for women like Esther who really enjoy sex and who are open to having sex with monsters. Esther's interest is piqued, and she meets with the mistress of the manor, Magdalena Mortimer, who gives her her terms of employment. Esther will not be mistreated. She can always say no to a match, and she will be paid to do one of the things that she loves most, to have sex. Esther is quickly matched with Dr. Underwood, as well as a vampire named Auguste and a sphinx named Amon. Esther forms an attachment with her butler, a marble golem named Booker, and a human man who is cursed with invisibility named Ezra. Esther has a lot of terrific sex with her men and discovers that in addition to having sex, she also really enjoys developing the intimacy she experiences with each of them. In turn, her men appreciate her kindness and openness and her acceptance. However, not all in the monster community appreciate the home that Magdalena has created in Rooksgrave. And one monster, Bersha, has made it his mission to not only destroy Rooksgrave, but specifically to destroy Esther. Will Esther and her men survive the trials posed to them by Bersha? Spoilers abound. I think we've both read this story before, right?
Yes, I've read it several times.
Yeah, it's great.
Really great.
It's good on a reread. There are so many things about this story that I appreciate. Like, the monster fucking. We have sex work that's portrayed in a positive way. We have polyamory and a woman who loves sex and who's always loved sex and isn't just magically set free by a man's cock. We also have male, male, female interactions, and I just adore those. Voyeurism, exhibitionism, electricity play, bondage, orgasm delay, a version of knotting, but with a spur instead of a knot because cats, and some power dynamics.
There's so much. I feel like somebody told the author, was like, I bet you can't do this. And she was like, I can. Watch. Watch me.
Just gave her a list of kinks and said, I bet you can't put all these in one story.
Yes. I love the book. It's so enjoyable. It's just an easy read and low stakes for the most part. You know, it's a good read. I read it. I think I told you this though. I read it for the first time on an airplane with like this woman sitting next to me. Like, this is really awkward. I mean, I'm not gonna stop, but what if she looks over? Because we get sex, I think, literally on page 10 is when it starts. Like,
Yeah.
so.
She dives in early, and I love that. I love it when you know exactly where you stand with a book. You know, it starts off, you don't have to wait. And that's the thing with a lot of like romance novels, you have to wait until like 60% into the book before sex happens. Not so here. Nope. It's from the very start. It opens with her spying on someone being pleasured. And that just sets the tone.
I think that it book's sort of written like backwards, like in terms of like a typical like fantasy romance or monster romance novel, right? Because there's so much sex, like, well, I mean, through like most of it. A lot, there's a lot like in the beginning and stuff, and then it turns more to romance near the end more. There's like not so much sex. They're developing more of an emotional connection. And I thought it's also interesting that it's kind of backwards that way, because it starts off very much like, oh, this is like straight up erotica almost, right? And then we get into, you know, more depth and stuff.
On a scale, so on the spice meter, you know, like from one chili pepper to five chili peppers, how would you rank this book?
I guess four chili peppers, because five I would think is just for like pure erotica, basically. If we're modifying that, you know, and saying we're only including like books that are not erotica, you know, this would be five out of five chilies, but I would put four otherwise, because in my head, that's all right. What
See,
about you?
I agree with that. I think that chili pepper rating is like not, I don't think that that's it when it, because to me, like five chili peppers is straight up porn, and there is a lot of like sex in this book. But I come to think of more like Katie Roberts, like your dad will do, like that deliciously taboo, or it's called like something taboo series that she has. That's basically just porn. And even like the her, oh, I forget, it's the one with the villains that she's written as well with Disney villains, but mostly porn. But in that, like the chili pepper rating, like five is not, it's not porn. It's like multiple really descriptive open romance scenes. And so I had this conversation when I was talking with Lala about Bride over on my pelvic health page about like that ranking system. I just think it's interesting. I wouldn't, and I think that that expands kind of into a wider conversation that I've seen recently about how women are just reading like porn, right? That there was like an article that was written that someone wrote me or sent to me, which was infuriating. And then I feel like there's a lot of like TikToks. And I feel like this is one of those situations where Sarah J. Maas gets lumped in with it being like fairy porn, right? We can joke and call that fairy porn, but like there's hardly any sex in those books. Silver Flames had several you know, romantic scenes. But I mean, how many times have you watched a movie that wasn't porn and it had one or two sex scenes in it? Like a lot.
I'm on like a million Facebook pages, right? For books, and I've seen A Court of Thorns and Roses rated as like three chili peppers by some people. I was like, that is, I would give this like maybe a two. That's pushing it for me.
Yeah, it's just not like a lot. And so I think that that really highlights how different people's perspectives are when it comes to like the viewing of things. But romance novels, and things that are written maybe for like the female gaze or the female perspective, get like weaponized. And called porn to shame people for enjoying those types of books when there's nothing wrong with enjoying porn, especially particularly porn that is produced ethically. There's nothing wrong with enjoying books that have erotic scenes in them. There's nothing wrong with these things. I think it kind of circles back to like being erotophobic as a society in general.
I also think it really minimizes the author's work.
Yeah.
You know, reducing it down to that, because so many of these have really good world building, really good character growth. You know, and I think you're right. It comes from this root of sort of, I think it also comes from women, like the restriction that women have on their sexuality, right? Or not in general, like, you know, just in general, that society puts on women. And I also wonder if there's some toxic masculinity mixed in with it too, that they're reducing it down to this just porn thing.
Yes, you know? Say more.
Yeah, it feels like they're minimizing this and they're calling it porn and stuff like that to, I guess, maybe make them feel a little bit better, because we, I mean, look at the way we look recent. Look at the way we love these characters, right? These become like our book boyfriends and stuff, and what women want to see in men, right? This is written for women. And I think maybe there's some toxic masculinity if men read these books, or as they hear about these books and stuff, and what happens, that they push back and they're like, oh, it's just the equivalent to porn or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And with that, I had the thought that a lot of times it does seem like men, and maybe women do this too, but I've seen it specifically with men criticizing women for reading romance novels because it gives them unrealistic expectations for what men should be like. On the other side of that, we can say the same thing about porn, that most porn, a lot of porn, is created for the male gaze. So the people that are featured in porn, which is extraordinary to me too, because I read this book, it's called the Penis Book by Aaron Spitz, and he talks about how a lot of times porn viewership makes men feel really, really insecure about the size of their penis, when the majority of people are going to fall within a specific range that they would call normal for penises. And what you see in porn, you see the porn penis, which is usually a gigantic penis. And that is way outside of that upper limit of two standard deviations from the norm, like the mean, right?
Yeah.
Intentionally. That's why they pick those people.
Yep.
And so I think it's interesting that we have this, like, romance is unrealistic for women. Porn is unrealistic for everybody. Most of it, not all of it. There are some people who produce like ethical porn, and it's very representative. But
well, men in general, you know, look down on women maybe for enjoying this, right? Meanwhile, they enjoy visual porn, right? Instead of maybe written stuff, and criticize us for it, as you're saying. And at the same time, it's like, okay. And it's written by women for women, right? That's the thing. It's like, maybe if you created more ethical porn that was not all focused on the male gaze, right? We would
join you with yeah. that, you know?
Second to that, I think a lot of that again comes back to like, I don't know, like erotophobia.
Mm-hmm.
People feeling a lot of shame about enjoying sexual things, whoever the gay, like whoever is targeted. Mm-hmm. And then on the outside of that, specifically within the fantasy world, there are a lot of fantasy readers who really talk down about fantasy romance. Like, there's just this attitude, I feel like, within probably literature in general,
mm-hmm.
but specifically as it relates to fantasy, that it's, if it's not like a certain type of fantasy, then it's not true fantasy. And I will never understand this gatekeeping of reading.
No, not at all.
Let people read what they want to read. And if you don't like it, you don't have to.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you like fantasy? Name three fantasy authors and their books.
Like, I don't have to prove myself to you.
Yeah. Okay, so Dr. Underwood is using a vibrator on the lady of the house. I don't remember her name now.
Yes, Mrs. Pickering. I'm really curious about what early vibrators are like. I should have looked some up before we started this, because I'm imagining, I don't know, like a metal lobster. Like, it sounds alarming.
It does. For some reason, I pictured, do you know those massaging guns, right?
Oh, yeah.
That have like a thing on it and it just kind of like shoots you. That's what I was picturing in that scene, mm-hmm. With like her first scene with Dr. Underwood, where she can't see anything, you know? She's like, oh, what's happening? For some reason, that's what I pictured.
Oh, it looks like a sandblaster.
Mm hmm.
Yeah, no, like a fishing reel type of thing. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. No, it does look like a sandblaster or like a sander. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, kind of like a, oh gosh, one of those vibrating gun things you were talking about. Well, my, how far we've come.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness we have come so far. They talk about how, you know, he's using the vibrator to treat female hysteria, and that's not why the vibrator was created. That was debunked. There, I just finished a book about masturbation. Actually, it's called DIY. It's like the wild and weird history of masturbation by Dr. Eric Sprinkle, and it is super good and super interesting. And also, and he talks about how this was not, how the vibrator was not created to treat female hysteria. And also Esme Louise has a great podcast episode called The History of the Vibrator Is Not What You Think It Is on her podcast, Kinky History. You should listen to it. It's great. Her podcast is great, but she talks about how the vibrators were created for men, actually, to address muscle aches. So
I love her. She's fantastic. Mm-hmm. History. She's mm-hmm. great.
She just released a book too.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she's great. So I do think it's interesting. You know, the majority of women's physical and mental health care, like the history of it, is just pretty discouraging and terrible most of the time. But I do think that we should bring back calling into work sick to masturbate until you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And taking extended trips to the sea for your health.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be nice. Or, you know, just being left alone and not having to go to work when you're on your period.
Wouldn't it be great in the United States if we could just get, you know, universal women's, you know, or paid leave for people who are having children? Wouldn't that be great? They do that in other countries and they're just fine.
You know what I saw that was really interesting? Sorry. It's kind of related. So you know how birth rate around the country, like around the world, is going down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I saw this on TikTok. She outlined sort of what the solutions in quotations have been so far for this. And most of them are male focused, right? So on men being able to take multiple wives or something like that, instead of, I don't know, making it less dangerous for women to have children, providing more support, mm-hmm. you know, more access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh God, this was such a good point, and another thing to make me so angry.
Yeah, making childcare affordable.
Yeah.
That's insane. The cost of childcare is insane. Make it affordable. Make healthcare accessible.
Nope. Give men
Empower
people.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the solution. Mm-hmm. So we mentioned how Esther really, really likes sex, right? Which mm-hmm. is great. Love that. Although I was wondering if this is set in modern times, right? And now sex addiction is considered, is a thing. If she would fall into that category, because addiction, a lot of it is characterized by, right, lack of control and mm-hmm. compulsion, right? And that very first scene, right, she seems to have like some sort of compulsion or just completely lack of control that she's right there basically like masturbating in the hallway, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing though with addiction that comes along with it, I think so there are a couple qualifiers, is that it has to negatively impact like your life or your relationships in your life, right? So I don't yeah.
So they don't really consider sex addiction a true addiction. Like okay. it's not they don't there's actually a book, it's called The Myth of Sex Addiction. It's by Dr. David Lay. There's not like a DSM diagnosis for sex addiction. They don't really consider sex addiction to be a thing. Mm-hmm. There is compulsive sexual behavior or like out of control sexual behavior. But from my understanding, from all of the sex education stuff that I've done, the psychological community in general just doesn't really consider sex addiction to be a thing. Mm-hmm. But there is out of control sexual behavior, or compulsive sexual behavior. And you're right, the compulsivity is part of that. And the negative behavior or like the negative consequences for that, that's part of that as well. There's also like the preoccupation with participating in sexual activity when you're not participating in sexual activity. And like feeling a loss of control. I still don't know that we would truly consider her to be like compulsively sexual.
Mm-hmm.
She does kind of seem to be, I don't even know if she's totally out of control in this initial scene. There does seem to be some mention of like negative consequences that have happened in the past with her, though, at least being scorned by other people. And then I don't know that she lost a job. It kind of sounds like she may have lost a job for some type of sexual encounter with somebody.
Mm. Oh, yeah. They do mention that. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It does say that. Yeah.
So most of the and that's another thing that with like sex addiction, it's really hard to like qualify what counts as sexual. Like, how would you consider that? Because there's not like a negative withdrawal type of process. At what point, because it's so different for each person, there's not like an overdose type of process. Someone can have like 5 orgasms a day and still not feel out of control or compulsive versus someone who could have, you know, masturbated once a month and feel like a sex addict, right?
So, okay, yeah. So Esther has her rendezvous with Mr. Tanner and Jonathan, right? And mm-hmm. he sends her over to Rick's Grave Manor.
Mm-hmm.
And so she meets with, well, I think her like Magda, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's telling her all this stuff about it, and they bring up birth control.
Mm-hmm. And Magda's just like, do you not want to get pregnant? And Esther's like, how? And Magda says, magic. I wish it was that simple.
That would be fantastic, right?
That would be so great. If we could just bibbity bobbity boo that fertility cycle, yeah, that'd be freaking great. Yeah.
Or choose when our wombs are open, like in that Amelia Hudgens series.
Yeah. My womb is currently closed.
Closed for renovations.
closed permanently. No admittance. I do kind of like the terms that Esther is given for her employment. It's basically like the golden rule, but with sexual and physical contact. Like, nobody's going to treat you bad, but also, or touch you when you don't want to be touched or whatever. And you don't have to have sex with people if you don't want to, but you should also not touch people if they don't want you to touch them. Like, that's a great rule. Mm-hmm. I also like that she gets paid and that the cost of her room and board are not deducted from her wages.
Mm-hmm.
And she can say no to anyone anytime she wants.
Sounds pretty nice.
It sounds great. She talks about, or later in the book, there's one person that lives here who talks about how she stayed at the manor just for like 3 years and did not have any clients, but Magdalena just let her stay. That's what a spectacular working environment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't love the caveat about being careful not to make other people or her partners jealous. Like, you can be kind to people and your partners, but ultimately they're all adults who are responsible for their feelings, and she's allowed sexual autonomy.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, but I also think it's a monster book, and I feel like that lends some sort of, like, they can't necessarily always control their, like, the monsters, you know?
Yeah.
Can't necessarily always control their reactions, they're more heightened or whatever. So I think it's kind of a valid, like, rule, like, careful.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to get mauled by an angry werewolf.
Sure. Okay. That's fair. When Esther first meets August, he has been crafting a feast for her, which he then feeds her while telling her the Hades and Persephone story. And how perfect was that? Like, swoon.
Mm-hmm. I actually think one of my favorite parts of that scene is Esther's reaction when she says, "Oh no, Hades wasn't the bad guy."
Yeah.
We don't want him to be the bad guy. No.
No.
Immediately. No. That's, I just love that.
Oh yes. Me too. Yeah. It's just such a great scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dr. Underwood and Mr. Tanner definitely give, like, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde vibes, but, like, Mr. Tanner is just this big, growly monster daddy that likes to boss Esther around, and he has a magically growing penis, and I feel like we haven't seen one of those in a long time in a book.
We haven't. It's been a while.
Yeah.
What's those growing penises?
Yeah. I feel bad for Mr. Tanner. He's so worried about, like, being rejected. He won't let Esther look at him when she's having sex with him. And he, like, leaves the room when he's around and she's present so that she doesn't have to look at him. Like, let her love you.
I know.
He doesn't care.
I know.
Yeah. I love when she like, finally does get to see him. It's later on when they go to the theater and they're having sex in front of, like, an audience in the theater, and she, like, gets on top of him, like, they're having sex on the ground and she's on top of him on the stage, and calling him her monster. Mm-hmm. It's such a great moment.
It is. It really is. I love their relationship, and I love, you know, you know, Jonathan or Underwood and Tanner, how they work out, you know, their own relationship with each other and how to, you know, share, I guess, mm-hmm. the body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I also kind of picture him like the Hulk.
Yeah.
I imagine he's green.
No, he's not green.
I could have sworn there was something.
I just pictured, like, really prominent brow line and cheekbones, really prominent facial features, maybe, like, exceptionally veined and kind of hairy.
I just pictured green for some reason.
I kind of thought, when I feel like I was imagining him as a lion man.
Oh.
After, yeah, so okay. That's what I was, because it's been a long time since I read this book, right? Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I guess I thought he was a lion man after I read it the first time and was surprised to find that he was not a lion man when I reread it. So I don't know where that came from.
I mean, the first time I read the Throne of Glass series, I went the whole series thinking she was a redhead.
Yeah.
No idea how. It just happens sometimes.
It does. Brains are weird. You know, brains are weird. One of the companions to Esther that I enjoyed a little bit less than the others. Well, really, it's Ezra and Amon. I struggled with both of them for different reasons. I felt like Amon struggled the most with the polyamory, with accepting Esther's desire to be sexually explorative. She's polyamorous and she likes to have sex and she likes a lot of variety and is very curious about exploring her sexual desires with multiple people and is upfront with him.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time is telling him who she is. And he's like, but you're a queen and you deserve to be treated by a queen. And she's like, my dude, I'm a maid.
Right.
You may think that I need to be treated like a queen, but I don't even think that I need to be treated like a queen. I just want to enjoy people and you, if you'll let me. And he really seems to struggle with it.
Mm-hmm. He does. He comes around, you know.
Yeah, eventually. But it takes like the majority of the book.
Yeah.
For it to happen. And I don't think he doesn't really set himself up for success in his relationship with her initially, because he just like surprises her by showing up unexpectedly. He and Magdalena like barge into her room and she's just had sex with Ezra. And then he gets mad because she was with someone.
Mm-hmm.
They violated her privacy.
Yep.
And he's in his feelings because of it. Like, that's a him problem.
I do feel like he had a lot, like, I don't feel like he was in the book that much.
Yeah.
You know? So I guess I can kind of understand him feeling like an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Because he really, I don't think he had as many scenes as the others, or maybe he just didn't leave as much of an impact or something. I don't know. But yeah, so I can see him kind of feeling like an outsider or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
But no, he should not be all angry at her for, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. He also tries to negotiate monogamy with her in the middle of the sex, which that's, you don't do that.
No.
And then he later tries to dictate who her partners are. He like doesn't see Booker as like an equal in their relationship because he's made of marble. And he also refers to her as property at one point.
Yes.
Which is not great.
Yeah. He is like a gajillion years old too. So I guess he had to.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Esther rapidly and firmly corrects him.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I love that. And yeah. I love that she's able to do that. And she's just not intimidated because he is this. I mean, he's a Sphinx, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he's this big guy who's also a Sphinx and he's really rich and, you know, has been around forever, and typically probably there's like some power dynamic there going on, right? Because he can buy her fancy things and she's just nope, if you can't accept me, you can, you know, see yourself out, sort of thing,
right?
With him, which I loved seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does a really good job in advocating for her relationship needs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he expresses his feelings that he feels like his place had been claimed. And she says, it isn't, unless what you want from me is to possess me completely without room for the others.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, yes, all of those things that you just said, he's very used to getting his way. He is basically royalty.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does take a lot of courage for her to stand up to someone like that and say, I need this in a relationship. And if you can't get on board, then I'm sorry, but maybe this isn't the relationship for you. His scenes with her were terrific.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that does the like orgasm delay. And he's the one that has a spur, which I don't know how I feel about.
It doesn't sound pleasant.
No.
Because when I think of a spur, you know, I think of like horseback riding, right? Like,
yeah.
And that doesn't
that just mean... rolling around inside of your vagina.
I know it's not that. I know it's like a hook, it's some sort of like hook sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
But when you said spur, that was my first thought.
Giddy up. Yeah. She's describing like a scratchy feeling, I think. And I don't really want that in my vagina, but everybody is different. This is, I think, the first time that I've read a book that has some type of penile adaptation like that before. It's really different from like the knot.
Yeah.
So
I wonder if there's one out there who has a, maybe there's a shifter book with it, like with a cork. What is it? Is pigs that have corkscrew penises?
And ducks. Oh
and
my
ducks.
gosh. Yeah. I've never thought about that before.
You gotta write
oh
it.
Oh my gosh. How would that even work? Would that even fit in a regular vagina?
I don't know.
A duck shifter.
I'm sure nature finds a way, right?
I'm gonna make you quack, baby.
Oh boy.
Oh, that's funny. I've never thought about that, and now I'm horrified by the idea of it. Oh, that's funny. So you liked Ezra, though. You felt like he was a good addition.
Yeah, I did. And I felt like, so I mean, obviously he comes with the benefits of being able to turn invisible, right? Mm-hmm. That's great. But I just felt he could relate to Esther on the way the others couldn't, right? He's human. He also knows what it's like to not be rich in royalty, because all of her other men are, right? Or monsters, you know.
Yeah.
They are, right? So Auguste has been around forever and has accumulated wealth. We've got Amon. Dr. Underwood, he has money from, I guess, his practice and everything, right? So he's been, and he's a doctor. You do have the golem, but he doesn't have like life experience behind him.
Right.
Whereas I feel like Ezra can relate to her when they're going to Amon's house, and they're both like, oh God, we're going through the front door.
Yeah.
Thing. They have that moment where they can connect. And I think that's good to have that sort of a little bit of a balance and something to also connect her to her past.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. It kind of helps with like the wealth imbalance as well, like the power imbalance that comes with that. She may feel a little bit more evenly balanced knowing that she's not the only one that doesn't have any money or that didn't come from money. I guess she probably has money now since she's been working for Magdalena, but yeah, you're right. There's a scene in the grotto, which is underneath the manor, where Magdalena has gotten a request from a water demon and has asked Esther to have sex with him if she wants to, and Esther takes the job because of course she does, she's a curious lady. Esther can't swim. She takes a job with a water demon where she will be in the water of an unspecified depth, and she can't swim. Would you take a job with a water monster if you couldn't swim?
No, I would not.
I would not.
No, that seems unwise.
It does.
She has her reservations about it, though, right? Which
yeah.
I thought was really interesting because, you know, we talk about her being curious, and normally she goes into a lot of these scenarios, you look at the theater, just meeting her men, you know, and she's excited for it. She feels apprehensive at this. And I just want to be like, listen to your gut. Oh, like, if you've got that feeling, listen to it, you know?
Yeah. 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 I agree. The scene gave me a lot of things to think about with Booker, because he escorts her down there and sticks around in case she needs him. But he is made of marble. and he can't swim. And so Ezra talks about, because obviously things go awry with the water demon. It's possessed by Bersha and it tries to kill Esther, or kidnap her, I guess. It tries to drag her into the depths of the grotto. And so Booker rushes to try to save her, but he, you know, can't swim because he's made of rock. And so Ezra says that when he shows up, like he arrives and saves her, Booker is like up to his nose trying to get to her in the water. And it just gave me a lot to think about. Like, if they, for example, took a boat and the boat crashed and Booker was on the boat and he sank to the bottom of the ocean or the lake, could he just walk out?
That would be fine. Just walk on the bottom of the...
Just walk on the... I mean, it's not like he needs to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if, like, he gets a chip in his marble? Can they repair it? What happens if his nose gets knocked off? Can they, like... What do we do? Does he ejaculate? How do erections work when you're made of marble?
He said, she asked him about that, right? And he's like, I can be ready when you need me. But yeah, I did not think about
it. But how?
Will that magic? But I didn't think about the ejaculating part.
Just tiny little rocks.
I know, or like marbles, you know? Oh, look, afterwards we can play marbles.
Yeah. I don't know. And then if he was on the bottom of the ocean, would the pressure crack the marble? Like, what? Does he lose sentience at some point if he becomes, like, destructed to a certain degree?
I would think so. But I don't know. Is he maybe self-regenerating, too?
I don't know.
We got to talk to the author.
Yeah, I have questions. I have a lot of questions. She drops a lot of like things about different monsters in this book, and we don't ever get any extra details. Like, there's a woman whose partner is a fire demon. They have to have sex in a special room. How do they have sex? Is she in fireproof clothes? Do the flames not burn her? Does he have special magic that keeps her from being incinerated? How does it work?
Maybe there is a sequel to this book. It's not the same characters, but maybe there's a flame monster in that one. Or fire demon.
Yeah.
But yes, it lots of questions
mm-hmm.
with this. Yeah. So the other girls, right, they all have monsters as like their own monsters, like you're talking about the fire demon. And there's this one woman, I guess, not girl, who doesn't really want to be there. She's mean. Her name is Mary, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, she's not necessarily mean, but she's there just to make money and leave, right? But she doesn't treat her partners really well. And I just felt so bad for her partners.
Yeah.
You know? And on one hand, I get it. She's like, her situation was explained and she found herself in a situation where she's unhappy. Really, nothing that she did, right? Like, she had to pay off somebody else's debt, basically. So I feel bad for her in that sense, but at the same time, it's like, maybe don't also try to make the other women feel bad that they're enjoying this and treat your partners at, like, you like them, at least, you know?
Yeah.
Make some eye contact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think she's interesting, too, because... later on in the story, mm-hmm. Esther and Ezra catch her having sex with a human man.
Mm-hmm. And getting paid for that as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, not getting paid well.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I have no idea. Her situation is difficult, but she is really unkind. And I feel like if it came down to getting paid a lot to have sex with monsters who were, you know, held to a certain, like, whatever, and couldn't be unkind to me and just gave me gifts because of my vagina versus humans who shortchanged me and I had to have sex in a field with them.
Yeah.
Who are you going to pick? But
go with the monsters.
I don't know her life.
Mm-hmm.
every scene that she was in, I was thinking, like, girl, get another job. Mm-hmm. This ain't it for you.
Yeah.
She talks about how disgusting they are. Like, they know. Surely they know.
That's what makes me feel so bad for them. Yeah. It's like, they already feel bad enough about themselves. And now, you know.
Just monsters with low self-esteem.
Yeah.
They just want to be accepted.
Mm-hmm. Like that group scene, right? Where they mention how he tries to kiss her. Is it a vampire or a beaked? I don't remember. There were several monsters described. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he tries to kiss Mary. And she's just like, no, I'm, you know, just keeps trying to suck his dick. Which, you know, sure feels good. But he, you know, wanted a little bit of connection too.
Mm-hmm.
She did it the pretty woman style though. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kissing on the lips.
That scene was super hot.
Mm-hmm.
Their group scenes are awesome.
Yep. And one of the things I like about them is that how focused they are on Esther, right? So we have tons of reverse harems that we have out there, right? Or why choose books. And they pleasure the female character. But there is also, it seems like, sometimes a lot of focus on the male character mm-hmm. as well. And we have a scene, I think there's a scene where they just pleasure her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they'll just kind of take turns with that, you know? And mm-hmm. I like that. Seeing that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The scenes in this book, they are so good. Yeah.
Yeah, I've read it like 4 times.
Dr. Underwood and August and Esther go to a sex theater, which sounds like a terrific time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get on stage for the last act and Jonathan pleasures Esther with electricity,
mm-hmm.
which is written in a way that is very hot, but in real life, no, thank you.
This has got to be the only sex scene in this book that I do not like, and cannot enjoy. It does not sound hot to me, even when it's written as if it's hot. I can't. There's nothing about that appeals to me at all. And I mean, hey, if you want to do it, dude, like, it sounds painful. I mean, he even says, like, you're going to come in 3 shocks. It's going to hurt. I know. There's like pain and pleasure. It's a fine line sometimes, but I don't want to get electrocuted. Please don't.
Yeah. Okay. They end up having sex on the stage. That's when she claims Mr. Tanner. Mm-hmm. Very aggressive sex. But then Bersha shows up and like makes things weird. And like, he's such a buzzkill every time he shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Big rain on your parade, guy.
Yeah.
After this, they go back to August's house and have, I think, probably my favorite one of the group sex scene that they have at Amon's house later on. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite, but this scene that she has with Jonathan and August and herself, where August is having sex with her and then Jonathan is having sex with August.
So
good. I just adore it. Because he's also like, August is feeding on her mm-hmm. and then I think Mr. Tanner gets in. Like, it's just, I love the male female scenes.
Yes, that was a really good scene. And one of the things that I just felt fun about it, and also about this type of vampire, is that so he goes into like day sleep, mm-hmm. right? Where you can't wake him mm-hmm. at all, right? So they kind of like get things started before, you know, right as the sun starts going down, sort of thing, which I thought was fun.
Yes. And I liked that because this is where I struggle with like reality versus fantasy, right? So fantasy scenes versus reality scenes. It bothers me when like in scenes that are set in the real world where like the female is being woken up with like sex, or the male even is being woken up with sex, because having sex with someone while they're asleep is
right
assault.
Yes.
But in the context of this scene, she is giving, she is pleasuring August as the sun is setting and he is waking up. And I was very unbothered by that. And he was super into it.
Yes.
I don't, it's just something about the shift from reality to fantasy for some of this stuff.
Yep. Yeah, because I have a problem with, I guess it's like somnophilia, right?
Yeah.
And any sort of contemporary sort of thing, too. It's like,
yeah.
No, this makes me uncomfortable. But you read it in here, it's like, yeah.
Right, right. Unless that's something that someone has pre-negotiated in a relationship with someone.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I'm just bothered by it.
Yeah, it's real iffy on that consent.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. They make it back to Rook's Grave Manor, and Amon buys a house for all of them. So he's moving into like his acceptance of this polyamorous relationship, and he has dinner for them, and they have group sex, and it's really sweet. And they all just like do the teamwork approach to pleasuring her.
I love the aftercare in this.
Yes.
I just love it. Because it's, what, there are like six or seven of them, right? That's got to be, it's tiring.
Yeah.
And so they put her in a bath. I think Ezra feeds her, you know, just like hand feeds her at one point.
They massage
did that
her.
Too. Yeah, they massage
they
her.
The cuddles.
Mm-hmm. They give her like some oil to that, you know, to help
so she
with
won't
anything.
Have pain.
Yeah. It just sounds so nice.
It, yes, she's very cared for.
Yes.
Bersha shows up again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He embodies, so he takes over Booker's body at one point and tries to use Booker's body to kill Esther. But he's able to push him out, and then they tether. Booker decides that he wants to be tethered to Esther, which is super sweet. But then Bersha shows up again and burns down the manor, which sucks. I don't fully understand his motivations as a bad guy. It seems like it's power, like he wants people to suffer because he's suffering too.
I mean, it sounds like he's got like some, I don't know, I guess kink. I don't know if it's a kink if some people aren't involved, right? About hurting women, right?
Yeah.
And he wants, and he goes on a whole monologue about power, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I want power, you know, because he mentions rape, raping Esther, and then collecting monsters and breaking them until, you know, they become subservient to him. So I don't understand why he hyper fixated on Esther, because she seemed to like it.
Yeah,
like
what I gathered was like that she, because she, he wants monsters to feel isolated, I think, and unaccepted, because it's easier to control them. And she is very accepting of all of her monsters. And so that kind of thwarts his endeavors to exert control through being rejected by humans. Ezra and August get trapped in the manor, and so they go and try to rescue them, and Esther just runs straight into danger, and I hate it when they do that. Don't be that girl.
Every time I read it, I want to facepalm during that scene. Because there are so many things, like they're like that mimic, right? She lives in a world now where she knows there's some magic going on, right? And I know it's, she's so worried for her men, right? So she hears it and she takes off. So there's some, I get it, you're really worried. Come on, this is the like very basic trap that people set, like recording or a, you know, a parrot, like whatever can imitate somebody's voice, you know? And yeah.
They manage to escape Bersha. Esther stabs him. Everybody's safe. Nobody dies. I mean, well, some people die, but none of Esther's lovers die. And Esther is okay too. But they decide to go to Amun's like home in Egypt to discover more about Bersha to hopefully like take him down. Mm-hmm. And Magdalena mentions expanding the scope of her provisions for people from her manor because she's going to move to Amun's home mansion that he purchased for their polycule, mm-hmm. basically. Which I really like. She's planning to expand the scope of like sexual desires and types of relationships that are served by Rook's Grave Manor to encompass more than just male-female relationships. And I got the vibe that Amun's sister, Kepri, was interested in Magdalena. So
I picked up on that too. And there was also that other woman who was staying. She'd been there for, what, 9 years? 7, 9 years?
Yeah.
You know? And she's, I think she says she's staying for Magda or something to stay with her. So I wonder if maybe we get like a poly female, female, female.
Yeah, maybe so.
You know what I always feel bad about with these? This is kind of like a sidetrack because we use male and female a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? But in the real world, like if somebody uses female, you know, it's kind of derogatory. Like that's just what it is. And it's also exclusionary, right?
Yeah.
You know, but it's how it, like, it's just because those are the abbreviations too, male, female character, or not male, main female character, main male character.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Yeah, they are.
Mm-hmm. And I guess sometimes they're not technically, like, they're just, they're, because they're a different species than human, right?
Right.
So.
Yeah. At the end of the book, August offers to make Esther into a vampire so they can be together forever, which is super sweet.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been together for a year at that point. Which seems, I don't know, it would be soon, in my opinion, to turn someone into a vampire after your 1 year relationship. But I don't know. Like, what do you think would be like the typical time? How long should you be with a person before you decide to make them immortal? Like a year.
Yeah, like a year, 5 year, 10 year. Yeah. I don't know. That's hard because here's the thing. Like, it sounds like this kind of comes with the caveat of like, oh, we're staying together forever. And in which case,
right.
I don't know. That's really overwhelming.
Right. Right.
That's very overwhelming. If it was just, let me make you a vampire so you're immortal. And hey, maybe we can spend some of that immortality together,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. But this felt very much like, you know, tied into their relationship.
Yeah.
You know? So, I don't know. Yeah, 1 year is not enough time for that.
I mean, there's still a lot you don't know about a person after dating them for a year.
Mm-hmm. Kind of going back a little bit to Booker, right? It's mentioned that Magdalena has added some special features to his penis, right? Mm-hmm. So he has ridges, and then he's got like a tapered head, which Esther says makes penetration easier, right? So I have several questions about this. Why? Right? Like, did she anticipate this? It, like, that's what it's like, okay, did she either anticipate maybe one of her golems coming to life and like having desire like that? Or was it just like, you know what would be cool? Let's give him ridges. Like, and she's made multiples of them. Do you think that there are others that have different penile attachments? Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who's to say that Booker doesn't have some different penile options to choose from?
That's true. Yep.
And who's to say that, you know, Esther might not be able to ask Magdalena to give her a different one if she gets tired of the way that one, you know, kind of rides.
Yeah.
Let them know.
We have a lot of questions about Booker, don't we?
I'm very curious about Booker. I mostly, until she started bringing up his penis, I mostly just kind of thought of him as like Ken doll genitals, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, until this thing with the ridges came in. It's like, maybe you should have asked her what she wanted his penis to be like before you gave him one.
Mm-hmm.
What if she didn't want ridges?
Yeah.
I don't know.
What if she wanted something else?
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It seems like this is kind of the first time that one of her golems has been sexually involved with one of the ladies that live in the manor. So, you know, maybe she's just taking it as it comes.
Yeah, she is. I appreciate that she also lets Booker go, you know?
Yeah.
There's no sort of like, I don't know, either jealousy or like, no, you need to stay with me or I created you sort of thing. Yeah, possessiveness. Yeah. She's just, all right, cool. Tether you two together instead.
Yeah. He's so cute.
He is. He's such a sweetheart.
He is. I like how he's like, you know, he hardly says any words, but he's like, every morning, he's going to give her an orgasm and help her get dressed. Like, how kind is that?
Yes. It's fantastic.
She also never has a period in this book. Maybe they magicked them away with the possibility of pregnancy.
Yeah.
It sounds wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Did you have a favorite monster? Was Ezra your favorite? He wasn't a monster.
He wasn't a monster. I think a goose might have been my favorite.
Yeah.
What about you?
Him. Mm-hmm. Him and Mr. Tanner / Dr. Underwood together. Mm-hmm. Their little triad.
Yeah. I like that. Didn't he make chocolates?
Oh, yeah. He made all kinds of stuff for her.
Yeah.
Did you have a favorite quote?
I did, but you put it, so.
Oh, well, we could both talk about it. So our favorite quote is, "You don't have to wake up and be the same person every day, my darling girl." What did you like about that one?
I liked it for two reasons. One being, like, I think that's just a great statement in general. You can wake up, anyone can wake up and choose what you want to be that day, right? And maybe not like your career, but you can wake up, it's a new day, you know, and I can do something new, right? Mm-hmm. Act differently, work harder, like, you know, however you want to be different. But I also really like that for Esther, because she came from a life where she wasn't expected to be anything more than a maid, mm-hmm. right? And then even it comes up at some point in the, like later on in the book, I think, about how, what if she wants to learn something, like some sort of trade, you know? And I like, this is, I feel in a way it's kind of empowering her, you know? Yes. To be like,
absolutely.
You're not a maid, you know, you're not reduced to just a maid or just a sex worker or, you know, whatever. You can be whatever, you can be all of it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, for the same reasons. You do see a really big shift in Esther and the way that she views herself. And I think that this quote really kind of encompasses the possibility that she could be anything. She can still really love and enjoy sex and be a sex worker and develop skills and have other passions at the same time too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that wraps up A Lady of Rooksgrave Manor by Catherine Moon. Join us next time. We'll be discussing Aragon by Christopher Paolini. Thank you for listening to Literary Quest. We hope you enjoyed our episode. If you'd like to follow us on social media, we can be found at Literary Quest Podcast on Instagram or Facebook. You're also welcome to share your thoughts and ideas with us via email at literaryquestpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.